Hey, good afternoon, Michelle.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
I'm good. I guess we should start by introducing ourselves, because we haven't actually met.
No, we haven't. So should I introduce myself to you then? Or
sure.
Do we introduce each other? Okay, no. Well, I'm Michelle Goldberg. I think, you know, we've probably written for a number of the same publications.
I'm sure.
And so I feel like I almost feel like I know you, because I see your byline.
Yeah,
in so
me
many
too.
Of the same places that mine has been, and also so many others. But I am a writer. I worked at Salon.com for almost all of my 20s, but for the past 4 years, I've been mostly caught up writing books. I wrote a book about the religious right that came out in 2006 called Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. And shortly after that book did well enough to allow me to kind of parlay it into the book that I'd always wanted to write, which I'm doing now, about the global battle for reproductive rights, called The Means of Reproduction, which is coming out next year, and which I've, you know, been kind of circling the globe for the past year and a half or so working on.
Oh, good for you. I used to do that before kids. Well, if you were at Salon, we definitely were at least working for the same place, because I wrote for Salon for a lot of, 95 until about, a year or something ago. With that as a segue, I've freelanced all over the place. The last place I was on staff was U.S. News and World Report, which is a long time ago. Published two books, An American Story in 2000 and The End of Blackness in, 2004. And I'm working on about 18 other books that I can't decide. You talked about the book you always wanted to write. There's like four of them and I can't decide which one I'm doing. So in the meantime, I'm teaching journalism and just opining all over the place.
Yeah, well, there's enough to opine about lately.
There is, but I got to tell you, I'm getting to the point where, with this election cycle being so dragged out, I can't blame Joe Average for tuning out. It's gone on for a long time.
I know, I've been kind of dipping in and out of it, because I'll be in the States for a while, and I'll get incredibly caught up for it. Then I'll leave for a month or for 6 weeks. And it's hard to stay as invested when you're only reading, when you're going online to kind of catch up with the news every couple of days.
It would be great to be able to tune out for a month here and there and then get...
Well, yeah, otherwise I find myself, waking up at 4 a.m. with, Hillary Clinton election scenarios
exactly.
Going through my head.
And she said, what? Yeah. And then you're always doing these shows and stuff, so you have to keep up. But I don't know, sometimes I feel like we should just... We, meaning all of us citizens, should just boycott and insist that there just be a gag order, that none of them say or do anything for the next little bit here. Although I guess Tuesday is the official end of the Democratic candidate race, but
obviously
the state of affairs, who knows if it'll actually... Who knows? We'll see it's going to go all the way to Denver.
I have only just recently started to think that that's a possibility. I mean, I used to just kind of assume that, of course not, she wouldn't do that. I've always, thought well of her, even though I've never thought that she would be the best candidate. But I did used to think well of her as a person and as a politician. And it's interesting, I'm doing a story now about the way that some of her supporters, and I think her increasingly as well, are turning sexism into an alibi for her defeat, and she's really started talking much more about how she's in it to represent all the women who never thought they would see a woman president. She's started
right.
talking much more about sexism on the campaign trail, which she's entitled to talk about, obviously, and it's certainly there. But the way that it's become this new phase of the campaign in which, and so I'm going to this rally this weekend. Do you know about this? Count every vote rally.
If it doesn't involve animated characters, I probably don't know.
Well, and I think it's so interesting, now and this new political action committee called Women Count PAC that was formed by some people in her finance committee, they're the ones who've been taking out the full page ads in the newspapers
right,
that say,
yeah.
Hillary, we are the women of America, Hillary Clinton's voice is our voice and she's speaking for all of us. But anyway, a bunch of these groups that have been organizing a big rally outside the DNC committee meeting you know, essentially now saying that, that seating the Florida and Michigan delegations is a matter of feminist principle, which I find...
Well, you know, I have two political science degrees and a law degree. I'm kind of a freak for the rules, you know, and I'm torn. You know, I don't like the idea of disenfranchising people, but it's not the party that disenfranchised them. It was their own state decision makers, and it's, you know, and I was reading something yesterday about people who, back at the beginning, when they knew that their votes weren't going to count, didn't vote, but they would have had they known their votes were going to count. So it's so complicated, but it seems to me that what the rule of law means is that you make rules, and of course we're talking about criminal here, but it devolves down to every level. You make rules when you're calm and dispassionate, and then you have to live by them, you know, when things are not calm and not dispassionate.
Mm-hmm.
And if we decide case by case, oh, this will really be bad if we don't allow this breaking of the rules in this instance, then we don't have the rule of law, you know. So it bothers me that state officials decided to flout the party, and now they kind of want to have it both ways. So I'm not looking at it as much from, I don't really get to Hillary and whether she's being cynical or not. I think the people's beef is with their party leadership, and I just don't, states need to understand that they're not going to be able to get away with this. So why shouldn't more states do this in the future? And if things had worked out differently, then, you know, so people are just going to wait until it's situational to decide whether or not they want to abide by having flouted the rules. And then getting to Senator Clinton, you know, it's a sport in this country to hate the Clintons. It's really, and you seem like you're sort of with me, that people are so viscerally, just so hate them so much. It makes me just want to not participate. And I just don't get too worked up about their flaws, although the time...
But I guess I do, because I never did hate them. And I used to argue with people who would say, you know, that they are just, you know, that they're, you know, kind of Lady Macbeth and, you know, and that they are this kind of power-hungry monster couple. I mean, I feel like kind of a sucker because I always stuck up for them.
Now you've changed your opinion and you're starting to agree that they are.
Now I do start to feel like, yes, she would probably do anything. Not because I think she's a monster. What I've come to think about her is that I think that she thinks that she is such a paragon of righteousness, beset by such, you know, enemies who either have evil intent or else just don't understand that if they would just trust her, everything would be okay. So, you know,
right.
The world is full of either people who are too evil to agree with her or kind of too stupid to agree
right.
with her. And so anything she does, I mean, she's just doing it for the good of us all. And I think that that actually makes her almost more ruthless.
Well, what if she's just somebody who's absolutely determined to win at all costs? Does she really need to be amoral and venal and think she's so much better than everybody else, or is she just a ruthless competitor?
Well, I guess it depends on how she... Are those two things... I mean, when you're saying, is she really venal, or does she just want to win at all costs?
Right. Those are different failings. Winning at all costs is bad, but being amoral and...
It's not that I necessarily think that she's amoral. It's more that I think that... For example, I really do believe that she thinks that Obama cannot win, and that she is just trying to save the party from themselves.
But there's a lot to that. Do you think white people will vote for Barack Obama?
Well, you know, it's interesting because some of them won't, obviously. But I don't, as far as I've seen, all of the polls show that there's a pretty similar number of people that won't vote for women as that won't vote for African Americans.
But when it comes down to a white woman and a black man, and if you know anything about my past, you know that I'm considered to be an Uncle Tom among so I'm not just somebody who sees racism under every rock. But in the voting booth, and the Bradley effect has been kind of defunct, you know, where supposedly people say they're going to vote for the black candidate and then they actually don't, and
mm-hmm.
everybody thought they would because the polls had been so stable. I think that when it comes to president, and having this black guy who will suddenly become much more African, you know, symbolically than he's ever been before. And the things we heard coming out of West Virginia and Kentucky and places like that, I have to wonder when the, and I don't, some of the people who think they're going to vote for Obama, I think are going to find out that when it's time to vote, they actually can't. But then the question is, can you bring yourself to vote for a Republican, you know? So I think we're going to, I think we're learning a lot about ourselves as a country during this.
I mean, and one of
this.
The things that was so initially thrilling, I felt like, about Barack Obama's ascent is that I started to think, wow, maybe this country is a better country than I had realized.
Right. And I think most of us felt that way. And then we started learning ugly things and seeing ugly things about ourselves. And then this whole Barack is a Muslim thing. Oh,
yeah,
man,
Barack
that's
is a Muslim
so,
with a crazy Christian preacher, and how can we both?
Right, right. But it seems like these are all ways of not confronting the fact that your problem with him is that he's black, and you're grasping at these. I mean, who's turned on John McCain because of Hagee? I don't know how you pronounce his name.
Hagee.
But where is that same kind of outcry? So I don't know, but I don't think there's nothing to that point. Hillary Clinton's making a good argument that it's I'm not saying she's right, but it's a potent argument. This guy cannot win in November, and do we want, you know, Bush term three or term, what, four, if you count the father? That's not a little thing.
No, it's not a little thing, but I also think that because one thing we really don't know is which of them is more electable. I mean, I actually think, and I'm arguing in this piece that I'm writing, that on the one hand, there's no question that Hillary Clinton has been treated with kind of sexist disdain at a kind of jeering surface level of, you know, attention to her cleavage and her cackle and the kind of constant scrutiny of, you know, MSNBC and Chris Matthews and Keith Olbermann. However, I also think that on a kind of deeper level, at the same way that you're talking about people, these issues were ginned up that tapped into this kind of deeper anxiety about electing a black man. Mm-hmm. On a deeper level, we haven't even begun to dig into all of the psychodrama and all of the vulnerabilities that Hillary would bring to the race. And part of that is because Obama has, for reasons I don't really understand either, because I think he's been afraid of alienating the kind of middle-aged, middle-class women that he's going to need to win the popular vote. You know, maybe he's just temperamentally not as prone to attack. You know, maybe it's a sign of weakness. And then, meanwhile, the right has been holding their fire. So a lot of these kind of assumptions that she's put forward, you know, that being first lady qualifies you to be commander-in-chief, which to me is the deepest rationale of her campaign. You know, when she talks about her experience, that's what she means. You know, the idea, nobody has really dug into her, you know, has kind of revisited her role in, you know, shutting up Bill Clinton's women and getting them to sign affidavits, denying their affairs. Nobody has, there's a whole bunch of stuff about Hillary that would tap into some, you know, people's anxieties about electing a woman that has just gone kind of completely, that has completely passed us all by, or her just the fact that she was the one kind of solid leadership role she's had in her government career, which was as the head of the healthcare task force, was a disaster. And nobody has really been talking about that. So she's, you know, she doesn't really have experience. She doesn't really have a record of leadership. And this could all, in, I think, a more, you know, a more skillfully vicious campaign like the one we can maybe assume that McCain is going to run, this stuff is going to get chewed over. I think it's been a fault of the press that it hasn't been, that the real issues here haven't been aired. I mean, some of it is just about, you know, misogyny and can a woman lead, but there's also real issues with her record that have been completely ignored.
Well, I love the phrase, skillfully vicious. I love that phrase. I think you're right to a certain extent. A lot of those issues haven't been vetted, but I think there are some people who have tried. Slate, I know, especially Tim Noah, who's a friend at Slate, some people have tried to talk about those things and to talk about them in the way that they need to be talked, but it really hasn't been picked up on. And I think that the press has certainly been defanged in some ways that are our fault and is not our fault. Mm-hmm. the internet, and here we are on the internet, is killing print, and it's very difficult for people to pitch serious issues like that when, you know, you're confined to 1,000 words on the web, maybe. You're absolutely right. It's so difficult for us to, if Clinton had run against Edwards and that whole group, I can't even think of the other names of the people who ran on the Democratic side.
By
then we could have talked about men versus women.
Mm-hmm.
But since we've got a black person in there, we're trying to talk about race and gender at the same time, and we're trying to pat our heads and rub our stomachs, and it's really difficult to do. So it's like, well, wait a minute, this is racist, but wait a minute, that's sexist. So it was, I don't know, it's good, it's bad, it's the way it is that we had them at the same time. I know Senator Clinton is cursing her bad luck every day that Barack Obama came about when he did. So it's a horrible mess now. But I think I do think that we've been moved ahead orders of magnitude in from of this very superficial, very infantile ways of discussing race and gender. What about class? We never get to class, you know. So I think that this has moved us forward, but we still have so far to go.
But I think it also means that because it is such a mess and a muddle, and in certain ways a mystery, that the argument about electability, I mean, in a certain way, it has the virtue, they have the virtue of canceling each other out on the electability front and kind of clearing away some of that and allowing you to make a more substantive decision. You know, there's other elections where I could see, well, yeah, the candidate that, you know, really speaks to me is clearly not electable, so I'm going to go with X, Y, or Z.
Right.
Here, because there's no way to say that with any kind of certitude,
yeah,
it allows you to really ask, who do you wish would be president?
Yeah. I ask myself the electability question all the time, and it's, God, who knows? And at some point, we have to think about the notion of, we want to win elections, obviously, but there's something about being the party of ideas and the party, you know, obviously I'm a Democrat, there's no point in trying to cover that up. I don't have that kind of energy anymore. It takes a lot of energy to lie.
well, you know, I did a lot of going undercover for my first book, not for any extended period of time, but yeah, at the end of the day, you just feel completely desiccated.
Yeah. But I definitely want to hear what you've learned going around the world, and I'm a huge supporter of choice. So I don't want to end this without finding, and God, given what's going on in the world these days and the place of America in it, I'm dying to know what you're finding as you're traveling around. And I forgot where I was going with that. I think that for those of us who are Democrats who believe that the country is way, way, way off track, and I mean morally and philosophically, I mean, it's taken me a long time to accept that we're torturing people, you know? My parents were Jim Crow sharecroppers. I grew up at the tail end of segregation, and I really thought I had no illusions left.
Mm-hmm.
But America is just a different, maybe it never was, it's the way we never were, but we're torturing people. We've got this war going on, gas is $4 a gallon, things are in such disarray, and to my way of thinking, that's the GOP's fault in large measure. So there, to a certain extent, the Democratic Party needs to be sort of the party of moral redirection and the party of adults who are both philosophical and visionary but also practical. So to a certain extent, I don't want to lose an election because I think the stakes are unbelievably high. But I think there is something to planting this notion of a gas tax holiday over the summer. I mean, it boggles the mind.
Although, can I tell you something fascinating? I was interviewing one of the people who founded this Women Count PAC, and she was, like I said, I wrote my first book about the religious right and spent a lot of time in that world and often felt like I was going into this kind of parallel reality.
I read many reviews of your book.
What's that?
I read many reviews of your book.
Where, you know, everything that I knew of, you know, kind of all, where all the facts were upside down and, you know, it wasn't just different opinions, it was different facts. And I was interviewing this, you know, kind of prominent Hillary Clinton supporter, and she was telling me that Obama's failure to sign on with the gas tax holiday was just evidence of his total disregard for working people. And how could he do this? And and said it, you know, before I had just assumed that this was just a completely cynical maneuver.
Right.
I mean, I still assume that. But it was the first time I realized, oh, my God, people around her really believe this, you know, and
and
was really convinced that this is a sign of Obama's, you know, kind of incorrigible elitism. And
really, that's so this is what I mean when there's so, even if we lose, there's something to being the party that says, you know, line in the sand, you know, morally and in terms of being adults, you know, you're running out of something. So we're going to make it easier to get. I mean, when I came of age, when I was a kid in the 70s, we had the first oil embargo and there were lines around the corner and everybody was driving big gas. There was nothing but big gas guzzlers. And no, you know, Jimmy Carter did not say, I'm going to make gas artificially cheaper. You know, that's when we brought in small cars and we started conserving energy. And when did we stop being the country that pulled up its pants and said, okay, it's time to do the hard thing? When did we become the country of gimme, 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 and tomorrow I'm going to run out of money, but I refuse to think about that? And Bush goes over to Saudi Arabia and begs them to lower the price.
I mean, and I actually think that is probably the deepest difference between Hillary and Obama in terms of where their instincts are. You know, Hillary's instincts, I think, are, number one, that we have to win elections, and I agree, we do have to win elections, and so is much more willing to do whatever it takes and more to do that. You know, and she also, I think, you know, believes, I think that, you know, one of the kind of things that Obama has changed my mind about, you know, I used to kind of always repeat that old H.L. Mencken line about, you know, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people. And I believe that she, you know, kind of, that's in certain ways her kind of guiding philosophy, that she wishes them well, but they're so, you know, kind of deeply stupid and right, ignorant, and that you have to kind of work around that. And, you know, there's been a lot of her experiences in the White House and the kind of grotesque slanders that stuck to her and the, you know, kind of barrages of lies that they had to deal with. I can see why they've developed that intense cynicism.
Sure. Right.
But one of the things that Obama has always, that's so impressed me about Obama, is that he has kind of time and again been willing to stake his future on the proposition that that is not actually true. And
right,
that you can speak to people about unpleasant truths and complicated things.
And that you must. You
and
can
that you must. And
you
that
must.
It, yeah. And
that's
and
what
that he believes in it enough to think that that he can do that and still win, and that maybe the point is doing that even more than it is winning. As much as I feel like, you know, really the future of our country depends on winning this election.
Yes. Yes. But if we're all have to become, you know, decadent and moral and amoral and refusing to think about the future, we've got to think about the future. It's going to take us generations to get back to the place that America used to hold in the world. We've got to start now. And if all of our leaders, somebody's got to set an example. Somebody's got to set a standard. And I'm not sure at all that Barack Obama can make the trains run on time and actually be a good leader. But a good president, somebody who can sort of do what FDR did at a certain moment in history, what Harry Truman did at a certain moment in history, where people looked Americans in the eye and said, guess what, buckaroos, you know, and you know, our moral certitude and knowing that we're doing the right thing, you know, we'll have to take the place of being able to drive every place you want to go. And yes, we may have to leave Iraq, quote unquote, with our tails between our legs. I'm not saying that's what we have to do, but somebody who's willing to say the things that need to be said. And I'm terrified that if Barack or Hillary Clinton or whoever is willing to play that game, if that becomes the political norm,
I mean, that's been the political norm, right?
Obama's swimming against that tide.
And I guess I understand the argument that maybe it's, you know, I guess it would be the no, we can't argument.
Listen, which I've got to cut this off. I've got to pick up my kid, but I would absolutely love to try and finish this.
Yeah, anytime. I'm around.
And I really want to hear about what you're learning in your travels very, very much.
Well, yeah, maybe we could pick that up next time.
Okay, so why don't we do a countdown and sign off, I guess, is what we need to do.
Okay.
I guess that's what we need to do. We should say goodbye or something.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you. That just, like, flew by.
Yeah, and I want to pick this up and finish it. So until next time on Blogging Heads, okay?
Okay, thanks so
All
much.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.